So the last few months, actually since the end of June, we've been basically in a series of studies that have focused on what is the foundation of our trust in God. And the foundation of our trust in God is a conviction that God is in control of every circumstance. Big and small, good and bad, God's in control. We call that the doctrine of God's providence, his providing, active care for all that he has created for his own purposes. God is in complete control. We call that the doctrine of God's providence. This is what we've been studying. So we spent the first 5 weeks studying the life of Joseph. It was a biographical study, and we learned how Joseph experienced God's good providence through many, many years of suffering. The last 3 weeks, we focused on the problem of evil. This was not a biographical study. It was more or less a logical study. How in the world can we actually believe that there is a good God in control when so many bad things happen in this world? So many bad things are happening. And we focused on the reality that God actually sustains evil in this world. He could end it if he wanted, but he actually sustains it because this whole world, including every one of us as individuals, is created for Jesus' glory. And God assures us, we learned this the second week, that every experience of evil that we go through as Christians is designed to conform us to that greatest goal. It's designed to conform us to Jesus' image, that we would be more and more like him so that we forever would honor him by being like him. And then, of course, last week we studied how to respond when you're in difficult conversations with people and they're bringing up the problem of evil, saying it's so hard to believe in God when so many bad things are happening, either around them or in their very lives. And we talked about 10 ways to respond to people who are struggling with the problem of evil. Today we take another shift, and it's the first of 3 weeks that we're going to be studying Esther. Esther is going to focus on the exact same theme. We're moving back to a biographical study of someone who experiences many difficulties in life, and yet we see, as we look across the entire story, we see God's good providence at work in many challenging, even suffering experiences. Esther is different from Joseph, not only in the time period in which she lives about 1,000 years after Joseph, more than 1,000 years. Esther's not only different in that we have a woman rather than a man, but Esther's different from Joseph in the fact that I think most of us might be able to relate to her a little bit better than we relate to Joseph. Joseph is like the man of integrity, and almost every decision that Esther makes is of questionable integrity. It's very difficult to discern as you're reading this book. Is what she did right? We're just left with a lot of questions, and I think that's actually one of the main points of the book, and that's what I'm going to teach today. We're going to read the first two chapters, or most of them, and when we're done, I want to know what is your honest reaction to what we read. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants, the army of Persia and Media, and the nobles and governors of the provinces were all before him, while he showed the riches of his glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, in fact, 180 days, 6 months. Just before I go on, I want to explain a few details, okay? Ahasuerus. Some of you may have in your translations Xerxes. Ahasuerus and Xerxes I of Persia are the same individual, and some modern translations use his Persian name rather than his Hebrew name. He reigned over Persia for about 20 years, from 486 BC to 465 BC. This is now the third year of his reign, so we're in 483 BC is the historical setting. And the place that we're at is Susa. Some of you may be familiar with the Persian Gulf that shoots up westward, north and westward, in the Middle East, and you have Iran on the east side of the Persian Gulf. Susa sits about 100 miles off the tip, off the northwest tip of the Persian Gulf in western Iran. And actually now the town is known as Shush. And much of this palace has been uncovered in the last 100 or 150 years. What Ahasuerus seems to have done in Susa in 483 BC is hold like a big palace expo that lasted 6 months. And it seems to have opened and closed with major feasts. Ancient history actually indicates that these feasts could have been attended by as many as 15,000 dignitaries. These were massive feasts that were held, massive international expos, or cross-cultural expos, we might say, within the Persian Empire. Verse 5, when these days were completed and the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver. Archaeology tells us that these were solid gold and solid silver couches. They were sitting on mosaic pavement of porphyry and marble and mother of pearl and other precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. Drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. In other words, you can have what you want. The king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, this tips us off to the fact that he was drunk and is about to make a fool of himself, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of the king Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before him with her royal crown in order to show all the visitors her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs, and at this the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. I think it's safe to assume that Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, was asking his wife to do something lewd. Vashti probably did not refuse on moral grounds, because this was impure. She probably refused because she was arrogant. History says that what the king was making her do is something that typically the king would make the concubines, or what are sometimes called the second-class wives, do. And this is just below her. Verse 13 says, the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the 7 princes of Media and Persia, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom, according to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and of the officials, and this is the verdict that they give, this is the answer, the wisdom, the counsel that they give to the king when he asks this question. Let me just first, before we get to the counsel that these men offer, say that there are some great names here in Esther 1 and 2. So some of you might be expecting children. There are some great names to consider in here. There's really a treasure trove of great baby names in Esther. Think like Vashti. Ahasuerus is a great boy name. Twin boys might be Bigtha and Biztha. Those are great names. My favorite actually comes up in the second chapter, Shashgaz, I just wish I could have another boy to name Shashgaz. That's remarkable. If we do have another boy, Hannah promises that she'll kill me. So we're not praying for another boy. Anyway, sometimes it is just totally hard to relate to these ancient Persian names because they're so foreign to us. And as we were reading this as a family recently at breakfast, we read it in a couple verse chunks at a time at breakfast, the girls were just laughing at the names, and Hannah and I were laughing at the names too. And they said, "Those are such weird names. Why would anyone ever name their kids that?" And one of the comments Hannah made is, if the ancient Persians came to America and heard names like Karis and Tori, they would think that those names are weird too. So it goes both ways. And let's be sure that we're not guilty of cultural superiority, right? Thinking that our names are, they have to be better because we're familiar with them. Here is what they said. Here's what they said. The council gave this word to the king. Middle of verse 16. "Not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior is going to be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, 'King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she didn't come.' This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she is. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it's vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike." And this advice pleased the king and the princes. And the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man may be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. So, the king commands wives throughout his kingdom to offer absolute respect for their husbands. That's what happens. For all you mail couriers out there, I want to point out that the mail system, as it's described in verse 22, is historically famous. Herodotus, the famous Greek historian who wrote about 20 years after the assassination of King Ahasuerus, Herodotus, the Greek historian, described the Persian mail system like this. And by the way, Herodotus was a Greek historian, which means he hated the Persians, but he had to give it to them. Their mail system was awesome. He says that their horse-riding couriers were like this: "Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these valiant couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds." That literally comes from the Persian, a historic description in about 440 of this courier system that we're reading about in Esther, and it's going to come up at least two other times in the book. What we're reading about is apparently factual history. Chapter 2, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. And the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch who's in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen in the place of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who was a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. This doesn't mean that Mordecai was carried away. It means that his relative Kish was likely the one carried away. He, Mordecai, was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, so they're cousins. He was bringing her up. He had adopted her, for she had neither father nor mother, and the young woman had a beautiful figure. She was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women in the harem. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and he advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. But Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. That means she didn't let anyone know she was Jewish. Verse 11, and every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now, when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulation for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and then the next 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go into Ahasuerus's bedroom, and in the morning she'd return to the second harem in custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. Some have described the life of a king's concubine as luxurious desolation, lonely the rest of her life as she lived even in luxury. Verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her, and Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now that's 4 years after Vashti was deposed. Verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants, and it was Esther's feast. He granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. It was a time of celebration. We just read almost 2 chapters of the Bible. I will never apologize for long scripture readings. We need more and more of the Bible. In the first chapter, Queen Vashti loses her position when she refuses to submit to a lewd request from the drunken king. In Esther 2, the young virgin Esther wins the position of queen because she is taken in part of a beauty/sex contest. What's your reaction? Let me tell you how some people have reacted. Some people have reacted against Vashti, saying that we should learn from Esther 1 that godly wives need to submit to their husbands, not like Vashti. Is that just what Paul tells the church at Ephesus to do? Wives, submit to your husbands? Yikes! That is not what Esther 1 is in the Bible to teach us. Wives are called to be self-sacrificial, supportive helpers of their husbands, insofar as their husbands are worthy leaders asking them to do something that does not disobey God. We submit to God ultimately, and no man ultimately. God is our ultimate authority. Esther is not here in Esther 1 teaching wives to submit. Some strongly react against Mordecai. One historic Jewish commentator Abraham Sabah, reacted with anger toward Mordecai, saying, "Why didn't he risk his life to save Esther, to hide her, to keep her from Xerxes' harem?" He says also at Esther, "She should have committed suicide rather than let herself be abused by Xerxes, let alone marry him." That's a reaction with which I'm a bit more sympathetic. And that reaction is a couple hundred years old. Some react quite positively. Did you know that feminist interpreters of the Bible sometimes look at this and they say, Esther is one of these ancient books of the Bible that's pushing a feminist agenda. Vashti and Esther are feminist heroes. They're not feminist heroes. Both Vashti and Esther lived within their culture, and they submitted to a wicked king and husband, apparently. Others look much more negatively, and they say, how in the world could a book like this promote such chauvinism? Look at the mistreatment of women. And Karen Jobes helpfully points out that it's not promoting chauvinism either, because there were actually more eunuchs in the palace than there were virgins in the harem. I think most people know what a eunuch is, but history says that there were probably 500 a year brought into the palace. So you're not dealing with either feminism or chauvinism. You're dealing with a tyrant. You're dealing with an illustration that absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's what you've got going. Others have reacted against this story in a way that maybe some of us can relate to. Martin Luther is respected as the great church reformer in the 1500s. When he was around his dinner table with some of his students, he brashly said, and Martin Luther could be very, very brash, "I am so great an enemy to Esther because it has so many heathen unnaturalities." That basically means so many of the incidents are just godless and unnatural. And Luther didn't think that Esther belonged in the Bible. Thankfully, not everyone has taken Luther's opinion. He's entitled to his opinion, priesthood of the believer, but thankfully most Jews and Christians throughout history have not agreed with him. The most significant one would be Jesus. Jesus, on the road to Emmaus after his resurrection, was walking and talking with his disciples, and he told them how the law, the prophets, and the writings all pointed to him, and Esther holds a prominent place in the writings. Some react just as dismissively as Luther, but with much less disgust. They don't see Esther as history. They see this whole thing as fiction. Robert Alter, I quoted him a few weeks back because he says how incredible a story in world literature Joseph is. Robert Alter is the 50-year professor of Hebrew at University of California, Berkeley, and he describes Esther as manifest fantasy. He says, "It is a delightful story, completely absent of spiritual concerns, written primarily for entertainment, and it was invented in order to provide an as-if historical justification for a day of feasting and drinking." The problem, of course, with Alter's view is that Esther presents itself as history, and there are numerous historical verifications or justifications that what Esther is describing is, in fact, true. I mentioned already, for example, the postal system. The way it's describing life in the palace accords with the archaeological discoveries. So I come back to my question. What's your reaction? I think the best reactions involve repulsion and disgust. If your reaction to the reading of the first two chapters of Esther was, "This is in the Bible?" Yes, you're getting it, and you're getting it right. That should be the reaction. The right reaction to this passage is something like this. Ahasuerus is a conceited, godless, disgustingly immoral man. And his palace is marked by partying and abuse of every human under him, and a whole council of leaders who enable him to do it. Ironically, within a couple of years, a couple of those leaders are going to assassinate him. The bottom line point we should come away with, especially if you read the whole book, is that God's at work here. Even in that palace, in that country, under that tyrant's rule, in that setting, God's at work there. God's not absent there. He's there. If I tried to summarize it just succinctly, I would just say God is silently, or you might say invisibly, fulfilling his plan, working out his plan, even in the most secular government, even when his people are unwise or disobedient. And I just want to work out those three ideas quickly, and we'll observe the Lord's Supper. The first idea is this: God usually works out his plan silently. Silently. Every commentator on Esther, I can probably guarantee you that if you've got a study Bible with notes in it, one of the first notes in your Bible says, the name of God is not mentioned in Esther. Jews and Christians throughout history have recognized this. Last week I picked up the eyewitness books at the public library on Judaism, and I looked at what it describes about Esther and Purim, the feast that this book describes the origins of. And it simply says, unlike other biblical books, there is no mention of God in the book of Esther. Observant Jews believe that this shows that God is always working, even in ways that are not obvious. And this is something that Jews and Christians agree on. The main point of Esther is that God is at work even when you can't see it, even when you can't feel it. And let me just say, I would never expect any of you to feel the presence of God. God is non-physical. You bring the presence of God to bear in your life by faith. Don't look for feelings of the presence of God. Believe the presence of God. See, we, as followers of Jesus, have been given promises from Jesus himself saying, I will never leave you, not even to the end of the age. I will be with you always. We've been given promises of the presence of God like this. And I just want to remind you, and even remind myself right now, God's presence probably is not obvious in your life today, but he's at work. God's presence is probably not something you feel today, but it is true. He is with you. If you're a follower of Jesus, he will never, ever leave you or forsake you. Second idea I want to work out is this: God works out his plan even in the most secular place. This is a pagan country, Persia. It's full of pagan rituals. Like, it was actually encouraged that kings and their councilmen would make decisions while they were drunk, or they would set dates, important dates, on the national calendar by rolling dice. These are indicating a whole bunch of pagan ritual. The country, of course, is under an immoral despot. A couple Old Testament writers simply say, the book just seems to be so thoroughly secular. They're exactly right. And that, too, is part of the encouragement. Not only does God seem absent when he's actually present, but this is a completely secular world, and God is working in it because it's his world, it's his creation. Those are his creatures, and he is at work in this place. Christian, I just want to remind you that you must live in the confidence that God is working in your life. He's working out his plan for you, whether you live in Painesville or whether you live in Pyongyang. He is just as present in your life. If you grew up in a peaceful democracy, or if you grew up or end up moving to a totalitarian regime that's horrific. He's just as much at work in your life if you grew up in a pleasant Christian home or if you grew up kind of like Esther, without parents, in a less than ideal secular state where you're just used and abused. God is at work in both circumstances. You can't say, it's a lie to say that God only works in people's lives if they don't have a past. No. The Bible teaches right here that God is working out his plan even in the most secular of environments. The last point I want to develop is this, that God works out his plan even when his people are wise and disobedient. There's a lot of debate about whether Esther's right or wrong, whether Mordecai is right or wrong to become a part of the king's harem. But I want to tell you that I lean towards saying there are many evidences of Esther's disobedience, Esther and Mordecai's disobedience. The first one is, if you read other parts of the Old Testament, like the end of 2 Chronicles and the beginning of Ezra, that happened about 50 years before. Another Persian king named Cyrus actually decreed that all Jews could return to Jerusalem, and he would promote that, he would pay for some of it, he would make it easy for them, and the book of 2 Chronicles actually ends with a command, so go back. Apparently, there were some Jews living in various parts of the Persian Empire that just didn't obey. Another indication that Esther and Mordecai might be disobedient is the fact that Esther doesn't tell anybody she's a Jew, and then no one can tell. You would think that there might be some ways of life that Jewish people might have, like the way they talk, or various dietary restrictions, or people they won't bow down to, or gods they won't bow down to, that would indicate that's a Jew. That's a Jew right over there. She's not like the other people here. But the fact that she didn't mention that she was a Jew, and no one therefore could tell that she was a Jew, indicates that she probably was not living in obedience to God. Unlike Daniel, who lived a couple decades before. Daniel was in the stream of this same empire, and he and his friends suffered for the fact that they lived out their Jewish faith in a secular environment. Esther may have been a very different story had Esther been an obedient, faithful Jew. I think as well that Mordecai's allowance of Esther and even what appears to be his encouragement of Esther in the harem, and not only that, but her marrying of a pagan king, this had been obviously outlawed in Israel for 1,000 years, ever since Moses. Do not marry pagans was one of the main principles that Israeli parents should teach their children. And I think these are all indications that, yeah, what you have going on here is probably describing a scene of disobedience, of unfaithfulness. And yet, God's at work here. And there's encouragement, Christian. It should not encourage any one of us to disobey and go on in our disobedience because God works at us even when we disobey. So I guess my disobedience doesn't matter. No, that's not biblical thinking. But we should be encouraged that if we have been disobedient, or if we right now are being disobedient, we should be encouraged that our shepherd is going to keep leading us. And our shepherd is going to keep working out his plan in our lives. What we should do right now is use the goodness and the commitment, the faithfulness of our shepherd to draw us to repent and say, God, I'm sorry for living in rebellion. I am sorry. Would you please forgive me? And we need to get back up and trust that God is going to advance his agenda even though we've been disobedient, and he's even going to advance his agenda through our disobedience, just like he did with Esther. That's an incredible thing. God is going to advance his agenda even through his people's disobedience. I hope that you're encouraged, Christian, when you read this and react with disgust to what's going on in Esther 1. Your God is at work. He is right now working out his plan. His work is most of the time silent. He's at work even in the most secular of governments. He's at work even when his people are unwise or disobedient. There are some of you in here who may not be followers of Jesus, and you might think to yourself, would God ever work in an individual like me? An individual like me who's not lived for him to this point in my life, an individual who's got a bad past, would God ever work in someone like me? Absolutely. He loves to work in people like you. He loves to work where people would least expect it. And do you know what God's plan is right now? In Esther's day, it was before Jesus, and he was protecting Israel until the Messiah came. He was fulfilling his promises to Israel, protecting them until the Messiah came. And that's what the story of Esther is about. What's God doing in our day? He is advancing his church. He is seeing to it that his church advances and that people become followers of Jesus one by one throughout the world in every nation. And he will see that his church advances and the gates of hell will not withstand the advance of his church. He will see to it that that plan advances until the second coming of Jesus. His plan is being worked out in Esther. His plan, just a little farther down time, is being worked out today. And if you say, I think God might be challenging me to turn from my waywardness, to turn from my rebellion, and to commit myself to King Jesus, to make Jesus the humble, the pure king, the unselfish and self-sacrificial king, God is leading me to make him king and Lord of my life before he returns and takes over as King of Kings on this planet, you'd be getting the point of Esther. That's what God's doing today. He is wanting his gospel to advance in your life, no matter what your background or your past. I urge you to trust Jesus. Entrust your life to Jesus if you have not yet.